Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is Irina Lagunina, Director of Special Projects at RFERL's Russian Service. Irina, thanks very much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting, Steve.
All right. I may be starting to sound like a broken record, but records are being broken almost daily when it comes to the coronavirus in Russia, unfortunately. The number of new cases recorded daily has shot past 25,000 and reached a high so far of more than 27,500 on Friday. It's back down a little bit since then. The total number of cases is over 2.2 million, and about 40,000 deaths have officially been attributed to the coronavirus. And those official figures, particularly the death toll, are suspected by many experts to be lower than the real numbers for several reasons. There have been some new reports, I think, this week about that. Now, the healthcare system is struggling, particularly in some of the regions. And on the other hand, there seems to be some optimism in Russia and other countries about the prospects for several vaccines. Russia and the U.S. That are being developed in Russia, the United States, and other countries. Irina, how would you describe the COVID-19 situation in Russia at the moment based on the Russian service's reporting and other evidence you've seen?
Well, Steve, just right now, just as we speak right now, there is new data on the mortality from COVID-19 in Russia. And this is a web resource which is called Media Zona, that got access to the informational center on monitoring of the situation with coronavirus, which was established in spring by the Ministry of Health of Russia. And according to the data of this information center, the death toll in Russia is 74,866 patients. They actually found out that certain regions, like 31 regions of Russia, report to the official figures exactly the number of this information center. Then 19 regions give lower data. The graphic is the same, but the proportion is smaller. And then 29 regions give data, official data, that has nothing to do with the information in this information center on the monitoring of COVID. So 74,000 is more, I think, is closer to the real situation, because, as you rightly pointed out, the official figures include only those patients whose main cause of death was COVID. But for example, if the person had diabetes and died even with a positive test on COVID, he or she would not be listed within the COVID mortality data. So this is more realistic figures. Russia right now is on the fourth place in Europe in terms of mortality from COVID, but that would put the country up, of course. Those statistics. The very grim development in Russia recently is the lack of medicine, and this is something new that we see in the reports, not only from Moscow, but also much worse in the regions. Two days ago, there was a case that really spread all over Russian social media and some independent media in Russia. That was the video appeal recorded by the anesthesiologist in Irkutsk area. His name is Alexander Lisovsky, and he works partly in COVID units, partly, but mostly in not COVID unit of the local hospital. And he made a very difficult surgery of appendix, and he could not find antibiotics to give to this 15-year-old girl whom he operated. And he was so desperate. He said that he doesn't know how to look in the eyes of the relatives and parents of this girl. And so he made this appeal that he needs antibiotics that are not available.
Right.
Such reports are coming from all over Russia. And partly it's because the system is on the edge of collapse. Partly because Russia really doesn't have enough capacity to produce as much as needed right now. You mentioned vaccine. It's the same situation with vaccine. Even though Russia created, produced right now two vaccines, and one that is pretty effective, it's Sputnik V. But it doesn't have capacity to produce it. So China will produce Russian vaccine according to the recent agreements. So the same with other medicine. Partly the problem is the system in Russia is different from European system, and the majority of medicine are in free trade. I mean, you don't need to have a prescription in order to buy antibiotics in Russia. And of course, this is actually proof of how panicking the people are, because all antiviral medicine and antibiotics were just bought out and stocked in people's houses because the people are afraid that COVID will get to them, and they will not be prepared, and they will not have medical assistance to cope with this disease.
Wow. So that's that's some fascinating, disturbing information, both in terms of, you know, what you're saying about kind of deficit of medicine as people hoard and stock up, and also the, you know, reported understatement of the death toll in a number of regions. You mentioned, I think you said the report is that it's the real toll is about 74,500. That's almost double the roughly 40,000, official deaths. So, quite a difference. Let's move on to the other topic today. Different country, but Russia's still involved. The situation in Belarus, in some ways, little has changed from past weeks. Large numbers of protesters are still demonstrating every weekend and at other times during the week against Alexander Lukashenko, accusing him of stealing the presidential election on August 9th, almost 4 months ago. And the police and security forces are continuing to crack down hard. Hundreds of people were arrested yesterday. And of course, there have been accusations of torture of detained protesters. But there have been some new developments as well, with Moscow in the thick of it. Lukashenko met on Thursday, I believe, with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who told him not to forget what he had agreed with Russian President Vladimir Putin at a meeting in Sochi in September. Now, while we know one of the things they discussed was constitutional change in Belarus that would alter the power structures, few people know exactly what those agreements were, because nobody has told us, essentially. But the expression on Lukashenko's face suggested that he knew exactly what Lavrov was talking about and was far from thrilled. And then the next day, Lukashenko said, and I believe it's the first time he's actually said this, that he will not be president under the new constitution. Now, it's unclear when a new constitution may be adopted. And there are plenty of ways to interpret Lukashenko's remarks. Irina, what's your take? Is Lukashenko genuinely saying he will abandon power at some point, or is something else going on? And what's Russia's role?
Well, you know, looking at the official media reports after this meeting, I can tell you one thing. Lavrov and Kremlin, to that extent, most probably didn't get what they wanted from Lukashenko, because otherwise there would be, glorious reports in the Russian state media glorifying the Russian diplomacy and the peaceful role that Kremlin is playing in Belarus and so on and so forth. Nothing like this took place. Mm-hmm. So that means that the meeting itself was pretty tough for both sides. The concern right now in Russia, and this is what once again everybody is pointing out, is that the share of people in Belarus who support the union state with Russia is actually shrinking. Mm-hmm. According to the recent polls, it shrank to from 9 to 11%, from about a little bit over 50% to 40%. At the same time, the share of people who are in favor of more close relations of Belarus with the European Union is growing. Mm-hmm. And this is the worst possible development for Russia, for Kremlin. I mean, it's a good development for Russia, but it's a very bad development for Kremlin. And I would say that I would really want to separate those two.
Right, no, absolutely.
So Lukashenko is trying to maneuver, of course, but nothing concrete was done since the Sochi. I mean, there is little talk about constitutional reform in Belarus, little talk about who can be the who can inherit powers from Lukashenko if he decides to step down.
Right.
And the majority of Russian experts actually looking at the situation right now prefer to speak about money that Lukashenko got from Russia. And this is a pattern that was in the past when Belarus was in a poor economic state. It always turned to Russia. Once the economic situation is a little bit better, Lukashenko actually was conducting pretty much independent policy from Russia. The proof of it, for example, the fact that Belarus, Lukashenko still didn't recognize the annexation of Crimea, unlike some of the other former Soviet states.
Right.
And this, as reports show, was also discussed during this meeting, because for Russia, it's for Kremlin, it's crucial that the most close state and regime to Moscow still doesn't recognize the annexation of Crimea. So the reason why they are talking about money is because Lukashenko got initially what he wanted. He got a delay in paying off the debt
right.
to Russia, and he and this is $1 billion. And he got some financial assistance for restructuring the Belarus debt to Russia. So that was the most crucial thing that he could get from Kremlin, and he got it. And he once again felt a little bit independent from Moscow. And I think that this is something that Russia is trying, or Kremlin is trying right now, to overthrow. To change in Lukashenko's behavior, because he is toxic for Kremlin right now. If the situation continues like it is right now in Belarus, then it's either the excessive, even more excessive use of force that would make it difficult for Kremlin to you know, embrace this right. regime, or it's you know, regime change to the more democratic and less sympathetic to Russia. And this is also a very bad situation, for a very bad outcome for Kremlin. Not speaking even about the fact that this example, and this is, this has always been Kremlin's concern, that the example of what they call colored revolution or people's revolution in Belarus can spread to Russia. This is the nightmare for Kremlin.
Right. So essentially, it seems like, you know, Russia is, I mean, a lot of the focus after this meeting between Lavrov and Lukashenko was on the perception, which I think I described, that, you know, Lukashenko was being told, don't forget what you promised. But as you mentioned, it sounds like, you know, the Kremlin was also unhappy and, you know, is unhappy with the prospect of either, you know, of basically change happening without Moscow having as much control over it as it would like. And you mentioned these two possible outcomes that would either way would, you know, would be quite bad for Putin's Kremlin, I think. So presumably they're trying to engineer a change that would allow them to keep as much keep their hands on the reins in Belarus as much as possible. And I guess you know, as time passes, that becomes increasingly difficult to do. So we will see what you know, what transpires and how things play out. Meanwhile, of course, the situation in Belarus is very stark, with, you know, people being detained you know, and abused by the state. So it's a situation that's been going on for nearly 4 months. All right, we're running out of time. We're going to have to wrap it up for today. Irina, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, I'll be back next Monday with another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia. Meanwhile, please keep an eye out on Friday for my Week in Russia newsletter. Thanks for listening.